Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and returning to the show with this very special musical theater episode is returning co-host David Lohr.
I got the show right here. No, I'll stop right there.
Okay, so as you know from downloading this podcast and looking at the title on it, this is going to be a podcast about the 1950s musical Guys and Dolls. But I'd like to start by talking a little bit about High School Musicals. In some ways, choosing Guys and Dolls was a little bit arbitrary. I spent a very short time conducting a completely unscientific poll of my friends about what musicals they did in high school, and Guys and Dolls came to the top. Other ones that came up were Bye Bye Birdie, Hello Dolly, and My Fair Lady. You did this in high school, right?
Guys and Dolls. This was senior year for me.
Yeah.
Because I want to say we were about an hour by train from Manhattan. So, you know, we would hop on the train and just go up and see shows all the time. And that meant that we had a very, maybe a larger sense of what we could accomplish or what we wanted to do for shows. So, like, I think one year we did do Bye Bye Birdie, but then one year they did Anything Goes, and this was before the Lincoln Center version. So they did the version from 1963. This is where everyone listening goes, the what? Yes, there are multiple versions of Anything Goes. I have them all. I like Cole Porter. Shoot me. See other podcast about theater where I talk all about Anything Goes. And that was the first time I got involved in any of this, because I was like, no, I'm a writer. I don't do that stuff. And the lead in Anything Goes that year was a student. He was a year ahead of me, named James Murphy. And if that name sounds familiar, that's because he is now LCD Sound System. So if you know LCD Sound System and you know Anything Goes, your brain just snapped. And the drama teacher talked him into doing that. She wanted him to do the lead in Anything Goes, and he didn't want to do it. And he made a deal with her. He would do it if, for his senior year, they could do Oliver, because he wanted to do Fagin, because that was just a much more challenging thing. And so, by God, my junior year, we did Oliver. And I think back in seventh or eighth grade, obviously I wasn't involved in it at that point, but the drama teacher took a sabbatical and a parent came in and did Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along, which is not a show that should work in a high school. And it didn't. So we did weird stuff.
Okay. And, David, I want to stop you for a second because you bring up two good points. One is, if you get theater nerds together, they will regale you with very long and meandering stories about theater. And two, the strange thing about High School Musicals, and I'm talking about this occurred to me years before Disney made High School Musical into a thing, is that the High School Musical was a place where non-theatrical kids would rub up against theatrical kids. And whether or not you ever had another moment of theater in your life, you experienced, if you went through a High School Musical, the exquisite pain of being in a production and dedicating so much of your waking hours, so many of your waking hours to this thing that if you were lucky, you would have, what, like four performances, maybe?
Four performances or six or something like that.
And it's such a peculiar, it's a peculiar thing because it's going on even as we speak around the country right now, you know, in I grew up, as I've said many times before, in a tiny little town in the middle of Illinois. I was not surrounded by people who concerned themselves with the arts. But by golly, every year the high school would put on a musical theater production. You get bitten by that bug, and you may never ever have the chance to do it again in your life, but you will probably go back and remember that, and you will probably know all the songs to at least one musical because of it.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, For Anything Goes, so that was my sophomore year. That was literally my sophomore year. And I was already working at the local newspaper and all. And so I covered it. I was doing the journalist side of things. So I did one story about the show. I did one story about Cole Porter. I did one story sitting in the orchestra pit and what it was like in the pit. Because our high school was really weirdly shaped. It was built in the 70s. And it was very mod. It had, like, you know, open classrooms. Like, three classrooms in a giant area. And, oh, it was very hip. And the auditorium was what they call a three-quarter thrust with no wings and just a wall. So it just sort of, it was a rounded stage and seats kind of all the way around that edge of it. And you had to go back behind this wall for, you know, to get off stage. And the orchestra pit was actually a loft above and behind that wall. So in 1987, they had this rudimentary video monitor system so that the conductor could see what was going on the stage. Otherwise, he'd have to sort of look over his shoulder over the wall. So that was a fascinating article. And, I that was all I was going to do. I don't get on a stage, right? I'm a writer. No. Writing is acting for shy people. And the second year, the next year, I was just fascinated by the fact that we were doing Oliver, and it was such a challenging thing. It's like the largest set they had ever built at that point. And, it was crazy. And my senior year, the thing with Guys and Dolls, there's a lot of male parts, and most of them have to be able to sing, and most of them are sort of low baritones and basses. And they managed to cast all of the good baritones who could act in speaking parts, which meant they had nobody for the chorus. And I was a choir nerd. So, most of my senior year, I spent almost every day hanging out in the choir room. I had a really nice senior year, but that's another story. And so one day, I think they were already a week into rehearsals, and the choir director, who was just my buddy at that point, he's like, "Hey, come here." I'm like, "What?" "Yes, come here. You like musicals, right?" "Yes." And he literally, like, walks me into the back of the theater space, which was across the hall from the choir room, walks me up to the drama teacher and goes, "Here's your bass section." And I turned and looked at him and said, "What the hell are you doing?" And so I was the entire bass section of the chorus for that production. I mean, I always loved musicals, but again, I don't get on a stage. So when I look at the videotape, and the videotape is actually on my desk 3 feet away from me as I speak, because I don't want anyone getting a hold of this blackmail material, you can see, like, in the Gambler's Ballet, in the second act, there are, like, 10 gamblers who are doing all these choreographed, coordinated moves, and they're looking out at the audience, and everyone's great, and there's one who is staring at his feet so he doesn't trip. That's me. But the aside from that, it was fun. It was kind of liberating. I discovered how to do business, right? How to have something to look like I'm occupied and not drawing attention away from anything, but so I'm not standing there like a deer in headlights. And just the whole experience of that was something I had never really done. And in a way, that kind of pushed me into theater for a profession, maybe. I don't know. It was exhilarating. And I wasn't even, like, the focus, except for a few couple of moments where the lead characters would walk past me, right? Or nod at me, or, you know, whatever. And so that is, there are shows that you memorize if you do them enough times. And I've picked up there are whole swaths of dialogue I have in my head from a play called A Night in November, which is a one-man show. We've done it so many times, I have most of that down cold. But Guys and Dolls, this spring marks 30 years, and I still have pretty much the whole show in my head. Right? It's crazy. It's crazy. Right.
Now, you bring up another good point here about not just high school musicals, but repertory theaters and community theaters around, you know, any place that is not, doesn't have a big budget, that's made up of well-intentioned amateurs and semi-professionals, is a lot of theater is about what's possible. And a lot of the musicals that get put on by high schools are dictated by the complexities of the set, the costuming, and the number of characters and the division of those characters between boys and girls, especially in high school.
Right.
Guys and Dolls is a little difficult that way because it basically has four main characters, two male, two female main characters, and then nearly everyone else who has a speaking line is male.
Pretty much. You have
the dancers. You have a. That's the one saving grace of Guys and Dolls, is that regular intervals throughout the musical, there are these set pieces, either taking place in a nightclub or with the gamblers or on the streets. You can kind of pad it, but it's not a great play for, you know, because let's be honest, you know, in high school, a lot more girls try out for the musical than boys do.
Oh, yes.
To the extent that I was looking up, you know, I was doing research for this online, and the character, one of the main characters in the play, Sarah, the romantic lead, has a grandfather named Arvide Abernathy, and in a young people's version of this play that's adapted, they remarked that Arvide could be easily played by a girl. and I was thinking to myself, boy, throw a really weak bone to someone there. That's not a not a great role.
I guess you have the mother superior of the Salvation Army mission, the Salvation Army, I guess. I'm trying to think.
The
Save a Soul mission. Thank you. We actually had a guy with really terrible. Powder in his hair. He did not look old. And I think he was at least a year older than Sarah, so there was that. But
now let's talk just briefly about this play historically. Guys and Dolls came out in 1950. People who are theater nerds like to point out two major moments in American musical theater, in the development of American musical theater. They like to point out Showboat, which was what?
1920. Let me look it up. I want to say 1926. Let's see if I'm right. 1927.
People like to point to Showboat as being the musical that got us all pointed in the direction of what's called the book musical, which is a unified piece of theater where all the songs arise out of the plot and out of the characters in the musical, rather than it simply being a review of songs and an occasion for there to be dance numbers that, you know, could sometimes be held together by the flimsiest of contrivances. And they like to point to Oklahoma, which was 1943. That was a musical that took the drama and the seriousness of what was happening, upped it enormously, and it also had this incredibly integrated dance. It was Martha Graham who did the original. Am I right about that? Martha Graham, right?
Yeah.
Right, who did the original staging of that. And so that those things kind of moved musical theater to the unified and more ambitious
Agnes DeMille.
direction that it was taking. Guys and Dolls is also an important play historically, in that it was a post-war Broadway play that set the stage for what was going to become the golden era of the 50s and 60s. And a lot of what we think of when we think of musicals, Lerner and Lowe, Rodgers and Hammerstein, going on into The Music Man and Hello Dolly and all that stuff, that all, I think, flows out of this moment of Guys and Dolls and the remarkable job that it does in setting a comedic tone, a light tone that nonetheless allows for enormous potential of character.
Oh yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, between Showboat and Guys and Dolls, you have a lot of silly musicals. You've got all the Gershwins, you've got all the Cole Porters, most of the Cole Porters. And there is still a book, but the songs could go in any order. The songs were written to just fit moments. For instance, in Anything Goes, the song that became the big hit at the time, I Get a Kick Out of You, is actually the first song in the show. And Porter insisted on that. Everything else, he was like, do whatever you want, but I want that one to be the first one, because all his society friends would come late to shows to show, we're making a big deal of entering late. And he said, I want them all to miss the song. And they did. And none of them could figure out why everybody was talking about this song. That wasn't in the show. So, aside from that, the songs could be in any order. And then you have Rodgers and Hammerstein teaming up. The thing that Showboat and Oklahoma have in common is Oscar Hammerstein writing the book. And, Jerome Kern was still doing lighthearted stuff and movie stuff too. And Hammerstein went on and teamed up with Rodgers after Lauren's heart died. And that's where you have that, the full blooming of what Hammerstein and Kern started in Showboat. But Guys and Dolls comes in that weird little period in between all of those. Like, leading up to that point, you still have things like Kiss Me, Kate, and Cole Porter's other great musical. And after that, all the shows that were like the shows in the 40s and 30s didn't quite do as well, because people wanted a little more depth to their characters. They wanted a little more weight. And it's kind of funny. I've always thought Guys and Dolls was inspired a little bit by the two gangsters in Kiss Me, Kate, which are very, textbook Damon Runyon type characters. And it was almost as if, Broadway looked at this and went, hey, that actually works in a musical format. And because that was 2 years before Guys and Dolls. Yeah. And I believe some of the producers were involved in both shows. But yeah, they went back to the source and said, hey, let's figure out how to put this on a stage. Let's hire Joe Swerling. Let's hire, I forget who was the other book writer first.
Abe Burrows.
Well, even before that, they brought in Abe Burrows to fix the show because none of it worked. And one of his jokes, he was a radio comedy writer at the time. He became famous after this as a Broadway show doctor, coming in and fixing musicals.
We're very inside baseball here, and I'm sure we're delighting half of the audience, and the other half of the audience is wondering when the next serial season is going to start. But just as a note, Guys and Dolls is a story about ne'er-do-well gangsters in New York City in and around the 1930s about era, even though this was written in 1950s. While the book is credited to Joe Swerling and Abe Burrows, they're adapted fairly closely from the material of Damon Runyon, who is the author of was the author of many, many short stories. He was actually a newspaper man who also wrote short stories, which is sadly not a career that many people have anymore, but it really was the career to have if you were a writer before World War II. There was, you know, newspapers themselves ran fiction and poetry and bridge columns and sports columns and all kinds of stuff. The whole idea that newspapers were supposed to be straight news, that was a kind of a post-war idea. They were newspapers and magazines in the early part of the 20th century were really freewheeling all over the place. Runyon wrote most frequently for Collier's, and he wrote these crazy stories about gangsters in New York in a dialect that nobody ever spoke.
it is pretty much, I mean, when they say something is Runyon-esque, it is literally only from Damon Runyon or people making fun of or trying to do that voice. It doesn't exist. And it is a very particular form of speaking in which you use as many words as possible to get the point across in a simple sentence like this. And preferably most of them come from the thesaurus instead of your head.
Also, the important thing is you never speak in past tense or in future tense. You are always speaking in the present tense.
I am coming to Mindy's for some cheesecake today. How would you like this? Right.
Exactly.
And it's a very particular rhythm too. It's like, you know it when you hear it.
If you read the original Runyon short stories, they share a lot of the flavor of earlier short stories in that there's usually a twist or some sort of a well-constructed turn to the plot. But the real pleasure comes in the dialogue, and the dialogue in the form of what the characters are saying, but even more so in the narrative voice, which partakes just as much in that voice as anything else does. Quite frequently, the narrator is an unnamed observer of the action. Now, the other thing I find interesting about this is written in 1950 about gangsters in New York in 1930. And what's interesting to me about that is New York City, it seems, has always been going through periods of seediness and then people cleaning it up. And whenever it gets too clean, people have nostalgia for the last seedy period. And, you know, so this is after the war. The GIs are all home. There's the baby boom is underway. And people are looking back with a kind of a weird nostalgia to the gangsters of yesterday, you know, the gangsters of the Prohibition era, and Runyon's stories are a lot seedier than this musical ever will be.
Well, when they did the Broadway revival in the 90s with Peter Gallagher
and Nathan Lane,
as Sky Masterson and Nathan Lane. This was what really, Nathan had been kicking around theater and TV. I remember he was in a sitcom in 1981 called One of the Boys with Mickey Rudy and Dana Carvey Saturday nights on NBC, and it was terrible. and so I knew who he was from that point on. But yeah, he was just this journeyman actor until Guys and Dolls, and he actually chose his name. That's not his real name. He chose his name Nathan Lane because he was such a fan of Nathan Detroit. So this was like the dream come true at that point. Great production. And they actually put out it was such a hit. They put out a collection of the best of Runyon's stories. Penguin Books put it out and everything with the Broadway show logo and all. And I grabbed it. I was like, oh, yes. And if all you know of Runyon is Guys and Dolls or Little Miss Marker or Pocketful of Miracles or, you know, several other movies based on his stories, these are a revelation. Oh, my God, this is not at all like what you're thinking. I mean, yeah, the language is there. The distinct agate that we think of as Runyon-esque is entirely incorporated into these stories, as quite obviously would be the point. But Yeah, these characters are not the cute, lovable gangsters and dippy women that you get in the musicals. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that makes it a little amazing to me that this, of all musicals, gets put on the high school level, because there's something weirdly subversive about that, that we are that we are supposed to be rooting for these gangsters. There's also this musical has this weird sly criticism of religion, particularly of evangelism, and it also has at the end of the play a kind of a weird take on marriage. So there's a lot here that's subversive to be put on at the local community theater.
I mean, even at the time in 1989, you know, we're putting on the show, and you know, I was one of the gamblers, so I didn't have to be on stage a lot. I could sit and watch the rehearsals. And again, you know, the more you're involved in it, the more you do it, the more the show sinks into your brain. Like, if you just watch it once, it's a fun show. If you've seen the movie a couple of times, like I had before that, it's a fun movie. You try and make sense of the plot, and there are little things that don't make sense, but it's a fun movie. And when you do it every day for 3 months, because we did like a 2 or 3 month rehearsal period, because everybody needed it. And you're doing it after school and going home by 6 o'clock. So, you know, and you start to pay attention to the details. You start to follow the dramaturgy of the thing. And you're like, why are we doing this in high school? Right? You have the Save a Soul mission, and yet you're supposed to root for the gangsters. And you have the guy who won't get married, and you're kind of rooting for him to not get married. And he's strung this woman along for 14 years. And what's going on? Right. And the women being the smartest ones in the story by the end of the show, where they're singing the marry the man today. How are we going to change the man? We're the ones who are going to control what he does and how he thinks, and everything will be great then. And that is such a weird song to finish your show. By the end of that whole production, all of us were like, what is this show?
You mentioned the female characters, and while this play has a dearth of female characters, it has possibly the greatest female character in all of American musical history, which is Adelaide. We are very, very fortunate that Vivian Blaine, who originated the role, got to reprise that in the film. The film is a mixed bag, and it's a peculiar film, because it stars Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra. And famously, Frank Sinatra was angry with Marlon Brando for getting the part of Skye Masterton. But you know, to be honest, neither of them would have been my first choice for this. Oh. And as mumbly and as not strong a singer as Marlon Brando is, he seems game to try a style of acting that's completely different from the method acting that we all know Marlon Brando for.
Well, the thing that struck me even the first time, I didn't know all the backstage story the first time I saw the movie, but I enjoy watching it now, because you can kind of see Frank seething through most of the film. He is just pissed to hell. And every time he has to look at Marlon, he's like, and yeah, they're neither one of them would be a good Skye Masterson. Marlon mumbles his way through. He's got the cool, like Skye Masterson should be cool, and he's got that. But yeah, he's not very good at it. But he gives it his all. He tries. And Frank is just pissed off. And like they changed around the one song to give Frank a singing part in that. And it actually kind of messes up that song. It doesn't make as much sense with him singing along, because it's all about how great he is. And we don't need him saying that. But yeah, it is sort of odd to cast the singer in the role that has one song and the actor in the role that has, like, you know, six or seven songs. And you know, he mostly gets the notes. It's close enough. It's fine. It's Marlon Brando. You know, he's going, luck be a lady tonight. You know, like, oh. But he tries. He's actually, this is, you know, he did, there are a lot of films where he's not even trying. This is a good role. He's fine. You know, for me.
He's also still young and gorgeous in this film. Yes. So that's worth seeing.
I mean, I would have cast Gene Kelly if I was going to cast anyone. I mean, if I couldn't just take the Broadway cast and transport them over. But, you know, if you have to have a star, I would have given it to Gene Kelly because he's got the cool, but he can sing.
Right. But this did start out as a panegyric to Vivian Blaine. And I do want to recommend that everybody go back and watch at least the scenes of Adelaide so you can see her. This part was written for her.
Right. She isn't really in the stories. They sort of crafted this just because she had auditioned for the role of Sarah and they didn't think she worked at it, but they really wanted her in the show.
Adelaide is, she's so funny and pathetic and smart and spunky and just, she's just so in control every minute she's on stage. And the other thing that that Adelaide is full of is this dialect humor and malapropisms that really mark this era in humor. There was a lot more. I think that around the middle of the 20th century is when we have things like, you know, Little Abner and stuff, and we have radio drama where dialect humor is so important. And Adelaide is just a great voice. And
oh, yeah.
It could work as well as a radio play as it does on stage. Miss Sarah, on the other hand, has a lot of very nice songs. She's not really well served as a character at all. She's kind of there to be the one that Skye chases. She doesn't get to live and breathe as a character.
Yeah, I mean, she has a certain depth that, again, your earlier musical comedy characters didn't, but she's not Skye or Sarah.
It's kind of wonderful to have this character, again, at a high school level. She's basically a burlesque performer.
Right. And
and my wife was in a production of this in high school, and she, I think one of the things that she has the fondest memory of is the song Take Back Your Mink, which is a striptease, basically. And there is something scandalous about that at that age. And if you feel like you're getting away with something when you're a teenager doing something like that, I guess.
Oh, yeah. And our costumer pushed it about as far as you could do, which is why all the gamblers stayed around for those rehearsals. That was, I've said too much. Adelaide is such a wonderful character. And Adelaide's Lament is, I mean, there are a lot of people who still consider that the greatest musical comedy song just because. And it's largely because of Vivian Blaine. I mean, yes, Frank Lesser, too. Because it's a very clever song. Because her whole thing is that she's been engaged to Nathan Detroit for 14 years. He has strung her along. He's taken her to Saratoga every year. And when is he going to marry her? And she has this wonderful song because she keeps sneezing, right? And, you know, she's not really sick, as far as we can tell. At least we played it as if she knew she wasn't sick.
Right.
But she's convinced that she's gotten a cold because he won't marry her. And the whole gist of the song is where she's looking up symptoms. And this might be the first Broadway show to use the term psychosomatic, right? there's the middle of the song. In other words, just from worrying whether the wedding is on or off, A person can develop a cough. You can feed her all day with the vitamin A and the bromo fizz, but the medicine never gets anywhere near where the trouble is. If she's getting a kind of a name for herself and the name ain't his, a poison can develop a cough. And so the whole thing, it's a really subtle, I mean, subtle song about how she's been living her life. You know, she's tired of getting the fisheye from the hotel clerk. Right. And, you know, even at that time, you couldn't really do stuff on Broadway of, you know, oh, they're sleeping around. And this gets away with it. It's delightful.
With Adelaide, you're challenged as an audience as to whether or not she is smart or dumb. She's reading a book on psychology, you know, which is also a sign of the times. Freud is becoming part and parcel of American culture in the 1930s, 1940s. And so here it is percolating into popular culture. And there's something funny about this burlesque performer reading this book on psychology, and yet she has it together the way that none of the other characters do. She's got all the other characters' numbers, and it's such a dance back and forth between whether you think of her as a victim, or whether you think of her as manipulative, whether you think of her as dumb, or whether she's just dumb like a fox.
Right.
And it all comes out in that wonderful, crazy voice of hers. And and so all those things together make her into, you know, I think an aspirational role if you're a woman in the theater.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe a little bit difficult to really perform as a child actor. When I was in high school, I remember I mentioned before that I was in a production of Hello, Dolly, and I remember at the time thinking that the girl who played Dolly was just an astonishing actor. Now that I'm older, it seems like a tall order to have a 15-year-old girl play Dolly Levi.
I mean, you need someone who is truly gifted. Like, there's a reason you don't often see the Music Man in high schools. And when you do, it's not really that good. You know, it's like the acting teacher or the choir director or whomever was like, we really want to do this. And they finally waited until they had a kid that they thought could do it. And sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. I did see a good Music Man in a high school once. So it can happen. It can happen. James Murphy would have been a good Music Man. That is something you have to think about. It's like, can they pull this off? I think ours was pretty good. I think she pulled it off because she could play ditzy but smart. Maybe not engaged for 14 years, but ditzy and smart. Yeah, another line that popped into my head from the song, because, like I said, the whole thing is still in my head, is knowing, you have to know a little bit about the geography, right? You have to know that Niagara Falls was a big wedding destination, a big honeymoon destination, and Saratoga is the home of Saratoga Springs and the horse racing. And so the line, the verse where she's singing, when they get on the train for Niagara, she can hear church bells chime. The compartment is air conditioned and the mood sublime. Then they get off at Saratoga for the 14th time. And there's no explanation. There are no notes telling you what these mean. You have to know what she's talking about. It's maybe the smartest song in the whole show.
There's a lot of these lines that exist in Guys and Dolls that have kept alive a small aspect of culture at the time that would otherwise have died. In the song Take Back Your Mink, they have the line, tell them to Hollanderize it for somebody else.
Right.
Which, if you look it up, Hollanderizing was a way of taking cheap furs and colorizing them so they look like high-end furs. But, you know, who the hell knows that anymore, you know? As I was reading over the script again for before this podcast, I noted that the beginning of the musical in what they call Running Land, which is this highly choreographed sequence of scene setting of what's going on here with this with this part of, I guess it's a part of Midtown Broadway, and the only way right. that you kind of know that is most of it takes place in this cafe called Mindy's, which was based on the real life Lindy's, which you can read up on Wikipedia if you want to. It was one of those New York fixtures where both showbiz elites and local mobsters hung out at. But they mentioned in this opening this lengthy set of stage directions, which are always, I find the funniest thing to read are stage directions because those are the first thing that any director throws away. So, you know, someone spent 3 days writing out 5 pages of stage directions. But one of the things,
hello, Eugene O'Neill.
Yes. But at the beginning, they talk about a couple who are selling paper dolls, which is kind of inscrutable to a modern audience, except for the fact that that's also a plot point in, of all things, Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, where he sells paper dolls. Apparently, there was a kind of a carnivalesque Barker aspect to selling these things, where you would do sort of a little marionette show as you sold the dolls. Now, the other thing about it was well known that there would be an accomplice who would take the opportunity while people were watching the doll performance to go around and pickpocket the audience. So that's all stuff that the audience watching in 1950 would presumably know. It's not anything that we know today.
Runyon Land is fascinating because normally a show would have an overture, and Runyon Land is a specifically composed piece of music. It is not just the overture, and it really sets the pace and the tone for the opening. It lets you know, oh, we're in a fast-paced place, and often it's staged where you get to see most of the characters breeze through and do, you know, dumb show kind of things, which is... Dumb show means silent actions, miming, and, you know, no dialogue. And as soon as that finishes, you have a call to post from a horse racing track, and the song Fugue for Tin Horns, where you get to meet three of the gamblers. And what is amazing to me about this, the whole thing is, you know, the repeating sounds, the repeating phrases and all, and each of them, it's not a round, it's kind of like a round, but they all have different lyrics and they all have different verses that weave together and sound good together, and it's the sounds of the words too and how they come in and out. If you know Hamilton and you love Hamilton and you've never heard of Guys and Dolls or looked at Guys and Dolls, this will remind you of Hamilton just in the way it's woven together. And when you look at the lyrics, it's three columns of words on top of each other, and it will look like the lyrics in the Hamilton book that you have read backwards and forwards. And again, you know, here's this show from 1950 kind of influencing forward. We didn't have that kind of integrated song like that before.
Yeah, this musical does some really interesting things with the order of songs and the way that songs lead one into another. Towards the end of Act One, after Sky has made a bet with Nathan Detroit that he can take any woman in New York
We should. I can do a quick synopsis because this doesn't make much sense without it. So Nathan Detroit is this gambler who runs the oldest established permanent floating crap game in New York, and all the gamblers are coming to town, and it would be great if we could have a crap game, right, Nathan? But he doesn't have a place. All the places he normally would use want too much rent money, and the back of the police station is out. And he figures out that he needs $1,000 to get to use Mrs. McCluskey's garage. And how is he going to get $1,000? Because he doesn't have $1,000. Hey, there's Sky Masterson. He'll bet anything. We can make a bet with Sky. And so he manages to make a bet with Sky that Sky can't get just any woman to go with him to Cuba. And Sky goes, oh, come on. Come on. That's crazy. I can get any woman I want. I'll let you pick the woman. And Nathan looks around and looks around. And there comes the Save a Soul Mission band coming in. And he goes, her. And points to Sarah Brown, who is this pure, wonderful missionary. And so Sky works his magic and it doesn't work. And he tries everything he can. And he does manage to get her to go to Cuba for a quick overnight trip. Nothing will happen, of course. It's just to show her the sights. Meanwhile, even though Nathan needed $1,000, he hasn't officially won the bet yet, and he doesn't have $1,000, but he realizes the Save a Soul mission is open because they've gone out on an all-night mission trip. And so they have a crap game in the back room of the Save a Soul mission. And so right there, that's the point where 12-year-old me is watching the movie going, wait a minute, he solved the problem. There's the crap game. But the movie keeps going. The story keeps going. And eventually they have another crap, the big crap game down in the sewer, because the sewer is for free. And again, you didn't need the $1,000 to get down there. So where is the plot? And it has always bothered me that we managed to have several crap games without Nathan ever getting the $1,000 he needed to have the crap game. I'm getting a little worked up over this. You can see this is stewed for like 35 years. But through the course of it, Sky and Sarah fall in love. Nathan and Adelaide finally walk down the aisle by the end of the show. You also have Benny Southstreet and Nicely Nicely Johnson, who are Nathan's helpers. They get to sing the title song of the show, which is unusual that you have the secondary comic relief singing the title song. By the end, in the crap game in the sewer, Sky makes a bet with all the gamblers to basically he will roll them for their souls. And if he wins, they all have to go to the Save a Soul mission and testify. And by the end of the show, they all wind up in the mission. And we have the probably if you've heard of Guys and Dolls and you only know one song, you probably know Sit Down, You're Rockin' the Boat, which is the big song for Nicely Nicely Johnson, where he testifies about this crazy dream he had last night. And by the end of the show, everybody's happy. It all works out. And we have like a quick reprise of Runyon Land. And that's the story.
In that sequence, right after Sky has taken Sarah to Cuba, that's also a thing that's good. It's important to note that this is a point. This is the last point in American history, right before the Cuban Revolution, right. 1953, when Cuba was basically the playground of the idle rich in America. They Cuba's fortune was as a place that people would do this, fly down and visit very easily. You know, I guess after Cuba went to Castro, Bermuda took up that role, I suppose. But right after Sky takes Sarah, they come back to New York, and there's two songs right after another, both by Sky, My Time of Day, and then there are maybe three lines of dialogue, and the music is continuing into those three lines of dialogue into I've Never Been in Love Before.
Right.
And I find it interesting that they did this. I suspect part of it is because in a weird way, My Time of Day could be seen as a very extended introduction to I've Never Been in Love Before. In some ways, it serves that role. If you've ever heard a song from the 20s, which you only know from its chorus, and then you suddenly hear the introduction, like the first time you hear the entire song of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and you hear this long introduction, like, what is this song? And then something like, oh, this is Somewhere Over the Rainbow. But the other thing about it is My Time of Day is an odd song out in this musical. It's a very it's not a typical musical number. It's more sort of an art song.
Right. It's not chorus, chorus, verse, or it's not verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus. You know, it's not like that. It's not, it doesn't have a real bridge. It's
kind of like a Schubert piece almost.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And then it moves into I've Never Been in Love Before, which is in some ways the most straightforward, gorgeous musical love song. And
right.
It's a song that gets done as a standard.
And it's kind of, I mean, the thing about Guys and Dolls, because Abe Burrows came in and rewrote the thing top to bottom, back to front, they revised it several times on the road before it hit Broadway. And you watch it today, and except for those little problems I pointed out about the crap games, it actually holds together really well. And it doesn't again follow that exact template that we know from musical comedy. And so the integrated musical, like we were talking about before, where, you know, the book and the songs fit together and they're meshed and everything. And people used to say to him, this is such a great show. And, you know, you integrated the songs, they fit the book. And he said, yeah, we actually did that backwards. We had all the songs first because we had to redo the whole script. And so we integrated it in reverse. So he was choosing where to put the songs. And it's a really interesting choice to put that right there, because that is almost the center of the show, almost the middle. And that really is where Sky makes that turn. He goes from being that gambler who's doing this as a cynical bet. And by the way, that's also really weird that we're seeing a High School Musical where the whole thing is about getting the hero to take a woman away for a night in another country. A little odd. And, but he does make that shift while they're in Havana, and he gets home and he opens up to her. My Time of Day is kind of like his mission statement almost. Like she says, you know, why do you do this? Why do you like this? And she's never seen the beauty of his side of the world before. And My Time of Day is such a beautiful evocation of nighttime in Manhattan. You know, my time of day is the dark time, a couple of deals before when the street belongs to the cop and the janitor with a mop. And the grocery clerks are all gone. I could do the whole show because I love singing it. And I'm going to stop now because I think we're covered by fair use because we're not charging anyone for this. And there's no band. But, you know, it's such a beautiful song. And it's like through that song, by opening up to her, that he realizes, you know, he's never done this. He's never been this genuine or open with anyone before. And what's beautiful is I've Never Been in Love Before becomes a duet by the end. And the two of them, like, she's realizing this too. And it's just this beautiful moment where the characters shift. And of course, by the end of that, you know, even though Sky successfully took her to Havana, he pays Nathan the $1,000 anyway. He says, nope, I didn't do it. You know, and protects her virtue. And that's, again, that's such a lovely moment.
What's also interesting to me about that, you do mention this opens up into, we've never been in love before, opens up into a duet. And it is an incredibly lovely and powerful duet for the two voices. That is mirrored in a weird way in the second act by Nathan and Adelaide singing Sue Me,
yes.
Which is a remarkable duet, an incredibly funny, incredibly sweet, just very silly duet. At this point, Adelaide has given up on Nathan, basically. Nathan
calls him out.
Right.
She calls him out and says,
well, it's
I'm
because
done.
Nathan says, I'm on my way to a prayer meeting. He's telling the truth. And
for
this
once.
Is the last, it's the last straw for her because she won't believe him. And Nathan has the line "so new." It's a Yiddish expression meaning "so what," you know, "so new."
Right.
But it was not known to the general white Anglo-Saxon public at the time.
I
love that. I love the way in which language creeps in here, and it stakes out its place.
And you know, Frank Lesser was Jewish, so of that course. Was clearly intentional.
Nathan Detroit, you know?
A little bit.
Yeah.
You know. And the back and forth between them, the call and response of this song, and they're two totally different paces, right? She's going at top speed because she's done. She's pissed. And, you know, you promised me this, you promised me that, you promised me anything under the sun. And, yeah, oh, I'm going flat. Let me try that again. You promised me this, you promised me that, you promised me anything under the sun. And you give me a kiss and you're grabbing her head and you're off to the races again when I think of the times gone by. And he's trying to get her to stop now. He's like, hey, whoa. And he slows it right down with his, you know, call a lawyer and sue me. What can you do me? I love you. Right. And he's trying to talk her back down. And, you know, all right, already, I'm just a no good Nick. All right, already, it's true. So new. So sue me. What can you do? You know, it's just this wonderful moment where for once he's being genuine, too. And he really does love her. But he really is on the way to this prayer meeting because he really did lose the bet to Sky down in the sewer. And Sky holds a marker with his soul. Right. And how can he explain that to her? Because it sounds preposterous. You know, it's again, beautifully constructed setup there.
Again, from a traditional construction standpoint, one would expect the big romantic number to be at the climax of the play. And instead, we have this sort of gently parodic, comedic love duet as the capper to the second act.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of things about this play that are strange and subversive. You mentioned the end of the end song between Adelaide and Sarah, Marry the Man Today, which is about settling, basically. And
right.
It's like, well, you know, let's just settle. Let's just get a ring on it, and then we can go about changing
We'll fix them.
But at the very end of the musical, where we get to see a little bit of what wedded life is going to be like for these couples, the indication is, you know, Sky has joined Sarah in the Save a Soul mission, but he still seems to be laying odds on everything. He still seems to be, you know, making bets.
I'll lay 8 to 10 that you'll be very happy.
Right. It ends just on the verge of Nathan and Adelaide getting married, but they still technically aren't married at the very end of the musical. So there's this funny subversive thing happening here where you're not really sure whether anyone has learned any lessons for the course of this play.
Oh, yeah. It's very sly that way. And between the way all of the plot is kind of, it kind of inverts a lot of the cliches and tropes that we know, and they're not, I'm trying to figure out how I want to say this. It's not an artificial situation that breaks up Sky and Sarah. It's an actual legitimate thing that she thinks he's responsible for that crap game in the mission, and he has no idea what was going on because he had nothing to do with it. But he's a gambler, and he distracted her, and that's what that was. And that is an actual conflict between their characters. That's not just, oh, I saw you kissing someone else, and I'm just going to pretend you weren't interested in me. And, you know, that's a legitimate breach of trust, at least from her point of view. And to have the second act not just be about him explaining himself, you know, trying to figure his way back into her heart, and there's no, you know, oh, I don't love him anymore. She has a moment with her father where she says, no, I love him, but I, you know, I don't think I can see him again. And her father is the one who says, he has this lovely song. Some people say it's the most boring song in the show, but it's, you know, this very lovely Irish lament more I cannot wish you than to wish you find your love, your own true love one day. And he's sort of saying, it's okay. If you love him, you love him. And that's that.
I was a little confused because I was looking up this character, Arvide Abernathy, who sings a song. And I've seen him referenced as her grandfather. But God knows. The other thing that's funny is Abernathy is a Scottish name. And I always felt that this song sounded highly, very Irish to me. But I guess it could be like a Highland song. It's kind of lesser putting on, doing a pastiche, you know.
Oh yeah.
Which is another thing about this is there's a real hodgepodge of approaches in this to music in this musical, which is remarkable. You know, when you think about like Rodgers and Hammerstein or. Even, you know, Lerner and Lowe and stuff, those are all much more of a piece.
Right.
This is a very eclectic musical.
It's got your fugue for tin horns, which is, I mean, a fugue is a very classical form, and he does a beautiful job with it. You have the oldest established, which is, I mean, there's a band behind it, but it could be a barbershop song. I mean, it is a beautiful men's chorus song. You have these burlesque show songs that are very much out of Lesser's history as a nightclub and cabaret songwriter. You have Adelaide's Lament, which is just this brilliant comic number. And If I Were a Bell, which is a lesser, no pun intended, comic number. And then My Time of Day, I've Never Been in Love, which is just this soaring, beautiful love thing. Love thing. That's a technical term, ladies and gentlemen. You have Luck Be a Lady, which is this just slamming number for a male singer. Sue Me, which is a great comic number. And again, a totally different tone and style. And Sit Down, You Rock in the Boat, which is the perhaps one of the ultimate showstopper 11 o'clock numbers, right? It is just the big number. You know, all these different styles, and he nails every one of the styles he tries. You know, so even with this sort of weird little Scottish-Irish thing, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful little song. Is it a unified score? I don't know. It's a great show.
Now, we could probably keep talking for hours, but I'm going to start to wrap this down here, but I wanted to bring up one last thing that we were talking a little bit about before we started actually recording this podcast, which is I've talked to a lot of my friends again about the musicals that we did in high school, and as I said, a lot of these names came up again and again, and they were all these musicals from the 50s and 60s, and there was a part of me that thought, oh, well, that makes sense, because after the 1980s, Broadway musicals became such technical spectacles that no high school in the world is going to put on an Andrew Lloyd Webber production. And then I thought to myself, am I right about that? Is it just because what is happening these days? What are kids doing in musicals today? And you said you might have some insight into this.
Well, it's interesting. They're coming out with junior editions of a lot of shows. So you can license either the actual show or a simplified version of it, which maybe is shorter, has fewer songs, fewer parts. All the Disney stuff that has been on Broadway has high school versions. And there are certain modern shows that are beginning to get a little attention. And then you will sometimes come across a super ambitious school. Now, I would say, you know, even though we were right, you know, an hour from Broadway, and we did Sondheim, we did like the most difficult Sondheim you can do, and it was terrible. Merrily We Roll Along is a show that runs in reverse, basically, and it starts with the characters very old and aging backwards. I mean, it just, no, you don't do that in high school. And the original Broadway production only lasted a few performances. Why are we doing this? Anyway, again, this is one of those things that's bothered me for years. But out here in Indiana, the local high school has put on several of the Disney shows. It's put on Oklahoma. I'm trying to think. They did another modern show. But it's pretty modest. We're in farm country here, and, you know, it's fine. But Floyd Central High School, down near Floyd's Knobs, a little outside Louisville, Kentucky, they are insane. They did, what was it? Did they do Titanic? Which, I probably shouldn't admit this. It's not my favorite musical, but it was on Broadway for a couple of months.
The early 90s, right?
Early 90s. And, you know, it's exactly about what you think it's about. And the ship goes down and it's, I don't know why you would write a musical about it, but okay. And they put this thing on with full on costumes and effects and lights. Their budget for that was more than the full year production budget at the college where my wife works times three. Like, we could have put on 3 years worth of shows for what they spent on this one production. And I watched it and I said, well, it looks great. The kids are okay. But, you know, out here, show choir is the thing. That's why the show Glee is set in the Midwest. And so some schools go all out and, you know, some of them can pull it off. Not every show is The Music Man. The Music Man is impossible for high school. If you're out there listening, don't do it. But there are shows where they're able to reconfigure it or simplify it. Or, I cannot wait to see the high school version of Hamilton, because that's going to be amazing. That is a show you could do. You're not going to do it exactly the way they did it on Broadway. You're not probably going to do a full version of it. You're not going to have Leslie Odom jumping on tables and doing all that. But it's a show that you could do in a high school, right? With maybe a couple of language edits. Just judging from a lot of the high school kids I know, they already have the lyrics memorized. So go with it, right? Avenue Q is one that I've seen some people try it, at least on the community level. And again, it's all about the creativity and how you stage it. So is it going to look like Broadway? No, it's fine. It's okay. Beauty and the Beast is, I've seen, they did that at the local high school. They did it well enough for a high school. I wouldn't choose to put it on. Great songs, but it's kind of technically really tough. I get the catalogs from all the different musical licensing organizations, and they're pushing all of these things. Grease Junior.
What? Grease Junior.
And that's that like, the other thing.
Sounds they like all, Muppet Babies.
Right. They all call them, you know, blank Junior. And I'm like, just call it the show. Just say it's the high school edition of the show. It's okay. There are a lot of the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. I think that's the name of it. Is that right? You can license that. There's a great show called Striking 12, which is inspired by the Little Match Girl by Hans Christian Andersen. There are a lot of interesting shows out there that schools are trying out now. And people are getting more ambitious. And the theater kids are discovering shows. They're discovering Jason Robert Brown and Lin-Manuel Miranda. And they're doing In the Heights all over. They're coming in saying, hey, could we do blank? So it's not just I can't remember the last time I saw Anything Goes or Bye Bye Birdie or any of the stuff when we were young. And that's OK. That's OK. Just not Titanic, please. Not Titanic or The Music Man. I love The Music Man. I always wanted to do The Music Man, but there was no way I was going to get on a stage and do that. Anyway. Oh, okay. Hi, listeners. Hi. Are you still here? Hi.
Okay.
Hang on. We got an 11 o'clock number. Okay.
Thanks to my co-host, David Lur. You can hear him on the Incomparable Radio Theater. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. You can join the Facebook group, or you can hit us up on the Incomparable membership Slack. Keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.